is NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Every country that hosts the Olympics hopes it'll reflect well on them, and Russia this year is no exception. In fact, the Sochi Winter Games are widely seen as President Vladimir Putin's latest and largest attempt to showcase his nation as a powerful, important global actor. But while the Olympics have put a spotlight on Sochi's stunning scenery, they've also shown a harsher light on Russian politics. Various groups have used the Games' international attention to promote their grievances, from repression of political opponents to laws seen as hostile to gay rights. President Obama chose not to attend the Olympics, which some viewed as a snub to Russia, and adding to the already tense relations between the United States and its former Cold War adversary. These chilly sentiments have built up over the Obama years, and both sides have had their complaints, from Russians feeling the U.S. meddles in its domestic affairs to the U.S. still stung over Russia's sheltering of NSA leaker Edward Snowden. Today in The Exchange, continuing cool weather between the U.S. and Russia and why it matters, let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests for the hour. With me in studio is Colonel Lionel Ingram, lecturer in political science at UNH. He teaches courses about international relations, including U.S.-Russia relations. He served for 30 years in the U.S. Army, including NATO tours in the office of the Secretary of Defense. And Colonel Ingram, it's nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
Also with us, Eric Clevin, assistant professor in the politics department at St. Anselm College. He does research on transnational terrorism and ethnic violence and teaches courses about human rights with a background including experience in the former Yugoslavia and the North Caucasus. And Professor Clevin, it's good to see you. Thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
And also joining us from Hanover, Daniel Benjamin, director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth. He was in the State Department's counterterrorism unit as a coordinator from 2009 to 2012, where he worked with Russians on security matters. By the way, he's speaking at a symposium later today at Dartmouth on this topic of U.S.-Russia relations. You can find out more information on that on our webpage. And Ambassador Benjamin, great to have you, too. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Well, and I want to start with you, actually, Ambassador Benjamin. Just get your broad thoughts. The Sochi Games, of course, have many days left, but so far, would you say they've been a net positive or a net negative for Russia's image in the world?
I think they've been a net positive for Russia's image insofar as nothing's gone terribly badly, and the Games have been pretty well coordinated. There's been apparent low visibility security in Sochi, and there have been lots of complaints about hotels and stray dogs and things like that, but nothing terribly outrageous. I think there's a lot of background static about Russia's relationship with the United States, its relationship with Europe. There are lots of issues out there, but the Games themselves seem to be going well.
So on a management level anyway, going pretty well. What did you make, though, Ambassador Benjamin, of all the attention prior to the Games mostly? Now the attention's on the athletes. But prior to the Games, there was a lot of talk about, you know, political repression in Russia.
Well, it's a very difficult situation. Russia has gone through a number of years in which the Putin government has really cracked down on civil society. It's made it it's made it very difficult to assemble in a non-governmental organization, an NGO. It's enacted repressive laws against homosexuals, against gay people. It has, imprisoned the rock band Pussy Riot. You know, it's been one thing after another. And so it's not surprising that you see this kind of news story. Additionally, Russia has extreme problems in the North Caucasus, a great deal of violence, extremism, Islamist terror. And so, you know, there's no making light of these challenges.
Yeah. And Professor Clevin, what did you make of this background static, as Ambassador Benjamin puts it, this stream of negative headlines before the Games?
Well, I think the Olympics have been a net positive, but it's also given people a chance to focus on some of these negative sides, and I think that's probably raised awareness for people who aren't aware of this, the kind of oppression and the situation of civil society in Russia, the human rights situation. I think that has come more to the fore in spite of the positive side of the games, too.
Can you elaborate on that? You said the human rights situation, and that's sort of a broad way to say lots of things going wrong. What does that mean exactly?
Well, as Ambassador Benjamin mentioned, there's been a lot of oppression of civil society groups. It's very difficult for them to operate openly. There are a lot of requirements for groups to register. It's difficult for them to cooperate with foreign NGOs that want to support them. There's restrictions on religious organizations in Russia. And I think especially in the North Caucasus, the oppression has been particularly severe. In Chechnya, they've really clamped down hard in order to end the insurgency there. They've clamped down quite hard on the society there, and it's very difficult to operate freely.
And that's your area of expertise. And just one more quick question. We'll get to this later, but the North Caucasus, Chechnya, other areas, these are regions, right, Professor Klevin, that might want to break away from Russia, a prospect that Russia does not enjoy.
Yeah, there are a number of republics. The Russian Federation is made up of a number of republics, and in the North Caucasus you have a lot of very tiny republics that are probably the size of some of the states in New England, but they have a lot of different ethnic groups. They have a lot of different languages. A lot of the ethnic groups in Russia are coexisting peacefully and are peacefully part of the Russian Federation, but Chechnya is really where a lot of the unrest began with a wish to break away from Russia, and that has since spread to some of these other republics like Dagestan and Ingushetia.
All right. And Colonel Ingram, I want to ask you a slightly different question. Relations between the U.S. and Russia. So no more Cold War. It officially ended with the downfall of the Soviet Union some 20 years ago. How chilly is it, though? Colonel Ingram, it's certainly not warm.
No, it's not warm. And I think the issue is not so much like the Cold War, where it's one state against the other. What we have here is a number of areas where our interests and their interests either come close, or there's conflict potential, or there's a possibility of cooperation. We have more recently the Ukrainian issue, which we've been out of to some degree, at least overtly. And that's a very important issue to both the EU and to Russia.
This is this is Ukraine debating whether to join the European Union and demonstrations in the street.
Or the degree
that.
Of control the Russia would have over the Ukrainian population and government. And then, of course, there's Syria in the Middle East. And we have the issue of what you're going to do with chemical weapons, which I think personally worked out very well. And then there's Iran. So there's a number of areas where we are dealing with them where their interest are different from ours. And on top of that, there's a general feeling that Putin wants to play a greater role in the world with Russia, and that he wants to bring down the view that the United States is the big power. And so this fuels some of the things that he's doing. And this is natural between two states.
And after the Soviet Union fell, Colonel Ingram, there were a lot of headlines about, okay, there's only one superpower left in the world, and you're saying that Russia's fighting against that impression.
There was never one superpower. There might have been one military superpower, but one of the things we forgot during the Cold War, all the things that were happening that were outside of the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union, we had the former colonies, which are now the Third World. We had the growth of economics. We had all sorts of things happening that were not directly related to the Cold War. After the Cold War disappeared, there was a sense that there was one superpower. But what we've seen is, at the same time, other states like Japan still around, China, Brazil, India, a number of other places can play a role, which we are much more of a pluralist world than we were a multipolar, bipolar, or unipolar.
All right. A lot more questions for all of you. But let me also invite our listeners to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. Today in the exchange, we're looking once again at U.S.-Russia relations and the spotlight that the Sochi Olympic Games have put on this testy relationship. We're looking at relations and why it matters, and we'd love to hear from you. Again, 1-800-892-6477.
1-800-892-NHPR. And Ambassador Benjamin, to that question, why does it matter? I mean, really, at some level, who cares if the U.S. and Russia are best friends or not?
It doesn't matter as much as it used to. That is, our ability to coexist and get along. It does matter because Russia, despite the fact that it's a significantly smaller country than when it was the USSR, still wields a veto in the Security Council and is therefore essentially a key member of the board of directors of the international community. And because Russia has historic ties and deep connections with a lot of countries where there are major issues. For example, Bashar al-Assad, Syria, is a close ally of Russia. And if you combine the position in the Security Council and its willingness, that is Russia's willingness to defend the interests of Syria, then Russia becomes an unavoidable partner, if you will, in dealing with these things. The same with Iran, not as close relations, but still very important ones. And, you know, the same with Ukraine, where their relationship is extremely historically close. I mean, Ukraine was, of course, part of the USSR. And additionally, you know, we're in an ever smaller globalized world. And so for Americans, for Westerners, things like human rights are very important, especially in a country that we trade with increasing frequency, that we invest in. So all these issues are, in a sense, unavoidable. Russia is not nearly as important today to us as China is, and that could not have been said 20 or 30 years ago. It is a changing picture, but Russia is still nonetheless very important.
Yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that too, Professor Klevin, why it still matters.
Well, I think it's right that it matters to the extent that the U.S. is able to pursue its foreign policy goals. And we're negotiating with Syria and Iran, and Russia plays an important role there. And so having good relations is important for being able to reach agreements which really impact U.S. interests abroad. And I think the human rights issue, too, is one I would raise. I think the U.S. cares about human rights around the world, and to be able to see progress on that area, it's also important because Russia has a huge influence on all of the former Soviet Union. They have an influence in Georgia and in Ukraine and in the Baltic countries. And so for that reason, too, I think it's important.
All right. We'll pick up on that in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Sign up your team for NHPR's second annual Trivia Smackdown. Flex your memory for minutia, and maybe you could be this year's champ. Spaces fill up quickly, so visit nhpr.org now to enter your team. This event is made possible in part by NEEPCO and the Common Man family of restaurants. More on the relations between the United States and Russia coming up on The Exchange. Then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, Implications of a World Without Snow. New Hampshire weather, partly to mostly sunny, cold today, high temperatures from teens to lower 20s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the University of New Hampshire, offering a two-day executive development program to build leadership skills that drive innovation. Program begins March 25th. More at execed.unh.edu. And the Colonial Theater in Keene presenting The Chieftains in an early celebration of St. Patrick's Day on Tuesday, March 11th at 7:30. Tickets and information at thecolonial.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about some of the geopolitical dramas forming the backdrop to the Sochi Olympics. That's the continuing tensions between the U.S. and Russia. We invite you to join us now with your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. All one word. We have three guests for the hour. Colonel Lionel Ingram is with us, lecturer in political science at UNH. Also, Professor Eric Klevin. He's in the politics department at St. Anselm College. And from Dartmouth College, Ambassador Daniel Benjamin, director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding. Again, the number for you to join us with your questions and comments and thoughts about U.S.-Russian relations, especially in light of the Olympics, is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. NewHampshireRadio.org. And Colonel Ingram, I'd like your thoughts also on this question of whether U.S.-Russia relations matter. You served for 30 years in the U.S. Army, including tours with NATO. I'm guessing 30 years ago, Russia mattered a ton.
Yes, it did. It's much more than 30 years ago when I was a cadet. I happened to be in Europe at the time when the Berlin Wall went up.
Wow.
So I've seen it from the Berlin Wall go up. And when I was just before I retired, the Berlin Wall went down. It obviously mattered then because they were a huge threat. Today, they're not that threat to our interests. They, of course, have nuclear weapons. They have as much as we do, at least. But they are no longer the primary concern of how we will behave. They're critical to us. As Dan mentioned, the Security Council position, they're critical to us because all the areas they touch, if you look at them on a map, they touch every area in the world except for Africa and South America.
Wow. And yeah, we forget how huge they are. Nine time zones, right?
I think it used to be 11, but they changed it to 9 recently. But they touch all these places, and they have these are to some degree not only opportunities for them, they're threats. They have threats from the standpoint of what Eric's going to be concerned about from the South, which are the traditional republics there, and they're Islamic. There are threats to the West, from the West, because of the kind of relationship between Ukraine and what people would like to be closer to the EU. And they certainly have threats from China. They've got opportunities in the North with the melting of the Arctic. So they're going to play in a lot of arenas that are important to us. And a point to make about Russian foreign policy is the fundamental aspect of Russia we're concerned about is domestic, over which we have very little control.
You know, it's really interesting what you say about the vastness of the country and the differences of those regions. In the opening ceremonies of the Olympics, they had those sort of islands of different cultures showing you here's a little village, here's a metropolitan city, here's the frozen north and so forth. And while that was very picturesque and very sort of visually poetic, Professor Klevin, Colonel Ingram's right. These threats on these vast borders shape Russia and its foreign policy toward the U.S. I'd love your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think also Russia sees or has perceived its power as declining, though, and I think that also is part of the equation here, that part of Putin's strategy has been to put Russia back on the map, to make them important again, and he's done that by, you know, wielding an iron hand in both domestic and foreign policy. And I think, you know, the way that they've dealt with the threats has been a varying degree of success. I mean, to one extent, they've hit back hard against the insurgents in the 90s in Chechnya. And I think in part that's also driven people to a more radical stance in some of the parts of the North Caucasus. So there's the threats have certainly shaped Russian policies at the same time that the other way, too.
Yeah, well, and certainly those uprisings and the Russians' crackdowns against those, pretty harsh in some areas, I remember, a few years back, Professor Klevin, have gotten a lot of headlines. Another subject that's gotten a lot of headlines, and Ambassador Benjamin, I want to ask you about this, is anger by the West over new laws in Russia seen as anti-gay, aimed at so-called gay propaganda. Where do those laws come from, Ambassador Benjamin? What's driving Russia to put those laws out there?
I'm not really sure I have a good answer for that. It seems to be part of the Putin sort of conservative macho agenda. This is a man who likes to pose, you know, bare-chested with assault rifles. And he appeals to certain xenophobic and reactionary impulses in Russian society. And I think that that's the main explanation, is that it's part of his cultivation of his own tough guy image and his own you know, constituency. Russia, you know, it's famously said Russia never had the Enlightenment. And Russia seems to want to, at times, underscore its own ability to buck current Western attitudes. You know, we're living in a period where the adoption of gay marriage, for example, in the West is wildfire. I mean, it's a social change on a scale and with a speed that has seldom been seen, and yet Russia is determined to go in the other direction. This is causing him lots of problems with his urban intelligentsia, with the urban elites. But he's done a pretty good job at clamping down on civil society, so he's gotten away with it.
Yeah, so he did get a lot of heat for that before the Olympics, for those laws. Does he care, Daniel Benjamin?
I think he has to care a bit about his standing. I was reading something interesting the other day that said that most Russians say that if the election were held again today, they would vote for Putin, but they can't wait to get rid of him in 2018. And so, it's an interesting paradox. Putin gets lots of credit among Russians for restoring order. And that is, something that he really brags on, if you will. But I don't think that most Russians view him as the kind of leader they want forever. I mean, it's kind of folly to talk about most Russians. I'd say that there's a strengthening constituency for modernization and westernization. And I think over the long term, I'm hopeful that that will turn out to be the case. Russia has a lot of challenges in making that happen. They have sliding commodity prices, and commodity prices are what keep Russia going right now, especially oil and natural gas. So there are going to be a lot of setbacks on the road forward, but I'd like to think that Russia still is going to modernize and look more like Western Europe in 50 years than like something else.
All right. Again, I want to invite our listeners to join us. Our number here in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Post a comment there. Our guests are talking about U.S.-Russian relations, and especially the spotlight that the Sochi Games have put on these relations and some of what the U.S. feels is human rights concerns in Russia. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Colonel Ingram and Professor Klevin, I'd like your thoughts, too, on you first, Colonel Ingram. Where do these laws that the Russian government calls against anti-gay propaganda, that's their language, where do these laws come from? Is it religiously based? Is it culturally based? What do you think?
I'm sort of like Dan. I'm not exactly sure, but I'd like to put into the consideration that Russia is not a pluralistic society. There are a lot of other aspects of the Russian society that Putin does not represent. And one of them is the very strong religious relationship with the Russian Orthodox Church. And I would imagine that a fair amount of this support comes from that particular conservative attitude towards human relations. And that's not unusual, that we find that in the West too. That it worked out to be sufficient, such strong laws is something different in why that developed. But I would suggest that one of the things that Putin is having to deal with, his power base in large measure, is conservative from the past, of people who see things from the past perspective. And what Dan is talking about, he hopes to see in the future, is going to be a generational change in attitude towards the West and towards things that we think are important that are going to work their way into the Russian society. But they're not there in strength yet. And I believe much of the support for these are coming from a conservative element, a particular attitude towards social relationships that are very, very powerful in the people who are speaking outwardly. The young folk, the next generations, are not that strong.
What do you think, Professor Klevin?
Well, I think the point that Russia hasn't had an enlightenment is an important one, and they also didn't have a Renaissance or a Reformation, and I think that has influenced Russian culture and thinking a great deal. But I would go even further and say a lot of Russian nationalism is directly, anti-enlightenment. Even great writers like Dostoevsky, you can read their novels and find diatribes against, Western culture and Western thinking. And I think that's a strain that has continued up to the present, and I think you know, Putin's attempt to rejuvenate Russia, he's really drawing on some of those strains that are xenophobic, that are that see Russia as the salvation of the rest of the world, the Russian soul as being important. And all when Russia did get some, you know, science and enlightenment and modernity, it came through the Soviet lens, right? So it wasn't science with openness and the kind of civil society we have. It was science that was strictly regulated. And a lot of the government bureaucracy that was there under the Soviet period is still there. And
well,
I think that influences the system a lot. And, of course, Putin is one of those representatives who's been through the system ever since the Soviet days.
I got to say, Professor Klevin, that's a pretty harsh critique. Russia not only never had the Enlightenment, it didn't have the Renaissance or the Reformation. Like, well, you really seem to be saying this is, I don't want to use the word backwards, but that's pretty harsh.
Well, I made a point once to a Russian friend of mine when I was traveling about some of the difficulties with dealing with the Russian bureaucracy. And I said, the problem is this bureaucracy is the same now as it was under the Soviet period. And he looked at me and said, no, it's the same all the way back to Peter the Great.
Do you want to jump in real quick, Ambassador Benjamin, and then let's go to our listeners? On my feeling wow, you guys are really, again, making some pretty strong critiques of Russian society, not just Putin, not just the government, but society in general.
No, first of all, I fully agree with the colonel about the religious influence. And I don't think there's any daylight between me and Professor Klevin. I think what is new and hopeful, rather than piling on, is that Russia is increasingly integrated into a global economy. That's going to make a difference. There are more Russians traveling abroad than there have ever been in all of human history by, you know, many orders of magnitude. All that's going to make a difference. We live in an increasingly globalized media world. So all those things are true. When I was an undergraduate, I took courses from Professor Richard Pipes, who was famous in the Reagan administration for being a hardliner, and he made the same argument that the continuities go back not just to Peter the Great, but to, you know, Ivan the Terrible in terms of some of the despotism we see in Russia. But I think over the long term, these broad historical forces will have positive influence.
Let's take a call if we could. Again, the number here in the exchange for you to join us with your comments, questions, thoughts about U.S.-Russia relations and why they matter is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. First up is Brad in Stowe, Vermont. Hi, Brad. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, morning.
Please. I have a question, and I read a book some time ago which was interesting called The Dead Hand, I believe it was called. And it talked about the challenge of securing former Soviet republic stockpiles of chemical and nuclear weapons. I'm wondering, with regard to now, the frosty relations between the U.S. and Russia, how is that affecting that challenge and that joint effort between Russia and the United States to continue to secure stockpiles of chemical and nuclear weapons in former Soviet republics?
Yeah, it's a great question, Brad. So not just reducing their own stockpiles, but securing the stockpiles in former Soviet republics and making sure they don't end up in the wrong hands. Thanks for the question, Brad. Colonel Ingram, you first on that. Do you know anything about that? He's right. That's a very important point and a big concern when the Soviet Union fell.
Well, one of the things that happened when the Soviet Union fell, we thought we were going to have two more nuclear states, and it ended up through negotiation with us and with the Russians and the other two states, all the weapons ended up in the Russian hands.
And what were those? Was it Ukraine and one other?
Kazakhstan.
Okay.
And also Belarus.
One of the things that we have also is that the Russians are – pardon me?
Go ahead.
Also
that was,
Belarus.
Yeah.
Oh, was Belarus the other one? There might have been three of them then. But the other issue is that the Russians are very strong supporters of the Non-Prolific Treaty. But they have a different view of how to manage it and how to carry it out. And this is a critical aspect of how we can move forward in trying to control weapons expansion. And this sometimes puts brakes on how we can deal with them because we do want them on board. They've been critical to it. And so it is not – we've got shortfalls in it. The last meeting they had, I think, was 4 years ago. There's one due soon from the treaty participants. Didn't make a lot of progress. And their loopholes, their shortfalls, their lack of concern about some of the issues related to the non-nuclear weapons states, and Russia plays a big role there. But they are a natural ally. within this arena.
Well, and that gets to your point earlier that all of you made, really, is yes, this relationship still very much matters, partly because, Ambassador Benjamin, of this nuclear material that's still out there. Go ahead. I know you want to jump in there, Ambassador Benjamin.
Well, it's absolutely true that this is one of the top items on the international agenda. I'm a little more positive about the progress that's been made. You know, back in the 90s, we thought nuclear terrorism was an inevitability because of the abundance of nuclear materials in the former Soviet Union. In fact, problems have been mostly elsewhere, from countries that were in the Warsaw Pact or other parts of the world. The cooperation with the Russians, it's always challenging. It's always there's always a certain amount of dentistry involved in getting big, proud countries to do what you want them to do. But overall, you know, this has been a remarkable record that we haven't seen any genuine nuclear threat emerge in this period. And certainly the denuclearization agreement of the mid-90s with Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan was an enormous success. And there were a number of really remarkable operations, such as flying out an enormous amount of highly enriched uranium in what was called Operation Sapphire, I believe, from Kazakhstan. So, look, this is going to be a concern for decades and decades to come, but the record thus far has been pretty good.
And Professor Klevin, is there a concern that with increasing tensions with these breakaway republics and, you know, uprisings in various areas, again, that's your area of expertise, is there concern that some of these groups might grab leftover nuclear material?
I'm not sure I'm as concerned about that as just the ability they have to do a lot of damage even without these kinds of weapons. I mean, the use of suicide terrorism, for example, is particularly damaging precisely because it allows terrorists to get into places where there are a lot of people, where they can wreak a lot of havoc. So I'm not sure that they need that. I think that the terrorism can do a lot of damage even without it.
You mentioned earlier two NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and them having a hard time working with like-minded Russian groups. Can you give us an example, again, in some of the areas where you've worked, where outside groups, whether they be from the UN or just the broader international community, have tried to come in and work with groups inside breakaway republics? I hate to keep calling them that, but for lack of a better word.
Well, some of the reason I was in Russia, I worked with NGOs that were trying to support support civil society organizations that were developing at the end of the 90s and the early 2000s, and it was very difficult. We had to be careful about what we were saying. One of my colleagues, who was a British national, had his visa revoked and has not been able to return to Russia since because he was seen as being a foreign agent, even though he was supporting charities that were doing work for children in the North Caucasus.
That's the suspicion.
I mean, and there's a lot of scrutiny of those kinds of things and scrutiny of religious organizations, even if they're charities, because of this threat to Russian culture and nationalism.
All right. We will talk more in just a moment. More of our conversation about U.S.-Russia relations, why they still matter, and we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, climate change and the implications of a world without snow. Then a new novel about a young girl growing up in the shadow of Mexico's drug wars. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Meridian Construction, a multifaceted contractor serving New Hampshire for over 20 years, pledging a strong partnership with every project they engage. Details at meridiannh.com. And New Hampshire Magazine announcing voting for Best of New Hampshire is underway. Ballots at bestofnh.com. New Hampshire Magazine, where New Hampshire comes to you. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about U.S.-Russia relations, especially in light of some of the tensions that have been highlighted by the Sochi Winter Games. Join us now with your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, let's go back to our listeners now. And Mariana's calling from South Berwick, Maine. Hi, Mariana. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. My question is about whether Russia's attempt to reestablish itself as a power perhaps risk changing the entire way we think of what great power means. And I'll explain why I'm asking that. It seems that ever since such thing as great power has existed in Europe and globally, they seem to have been following some kind of Spider-Man ethic, as you were. There was some kind of responsibility that was associated with being a great power. In colonial times, it was civilizing mission. And today it is the promotion of democracy and human rights, perhaps. But now that we see Russia making these aggressive attempts to reestablish itself, in particular in Ukraine, it is not guided by any type of universal logic or ethic. And just to preempt perhaps some reservations, of course these this responsibility or discourse and responsibility had often covered some other ulterior and more prosaic ends for great powers, but at least it gave some kind of criteria to the rest of the world to hold them responsible for how they exercise that power.
Mariana, good to hear from you. And I love her analogy, Ambassador Benjamin, of the Spider-Man ethic. With great power comes great responsibility. What do you think about her point? You know, if they want to be a great power, they need to act perhaps in a different way. What do you think, Ambassador Benjamin?
It's an interesting point, but I guess I don't agree with the premise. I mean, China is truly a great power, and it has no mission to civilize in any way. If anything, it's mission to purchase and sell. And in fact, many of the great powers of the past also may have at best had a patina of doing good in the world. But I think that when Germany was a rising power, no one would have accused it of bringing light into the natives. And the same is true. I mean, if you think of Belgium in Africa, I think that's a French model. It's an English model. It's been true. We understand ourselves as having certain international values or values that we want to propagate internationally. I think Russians would probably say that they stand for culture, for order, for sovereignty, and for resistance to overweening superpowers. A lot of it is going to be in the eye of the beholder, but I just don't really think I agree with that reading of history.
So how the U.S. propagates its values has also been questioned, Ambassador Benjamin. I mean, some would say, that Iraq war, which was supposedly to make the world safe for chemical weapons, didn't turn out to be an expression of great power responsibility.
Well, I opposed the Iraq war from months before it even began, and I thought it was one of the biggest errors in all of American history. So I would be with those who are critical. There's no question that we at times have erred in our efforts to propagate our values, or in this case, I'd say to enhance our security. I'm not sure that for all the talk of democratic revolution or the kind of democracy promotion that the Bush administration claimed to be pursuing, that it really was about that so much. I'm sure different players in the administration had different views on that, but we are certainly not without our own mistakes in these things. But I think the main thing that is, as a rising power right now, it's hard to see Russia as being a terribly benign presence on the international stage.
All right, Mariana, good to hear from you. Thank you very much for your call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange, all one word. Colonel Ingram, I'd love your thoughts on this. We've talked a lot about U.S. grievances toward Russia and Russia not being a quote-unquote good actor on the world stage. What are Russian grievances toward the U.S.? For example, a recent poll shows Russians are about 50-50 when asked if they thought new Cold War with the U.S. was brewing. So they're not feeling too great about us at this point either.
No, and many Russians feel that the outcome of the Cold War got them less than they thought they had bargained for. Their relationship to NATO was not what they thought they were going to get. I'm not exactly sure what they thought they were going to get, but it appears in their minds that they got a lot less influence than they expected. There was also a feeling from some who are much more democratically inclined and market inclined that the West could have done more for them. I don't know if we could have. Some of the advice we gave them was, I would suggest as an economist, 180 degrees out. We have the ABM Treaty.
The Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty.
Which we persuaded them was the way to go because of the issue of first strike, second strike, and how you maintain deterrence and stability. We persuaded them to go that way, and then all of a sudden we followed the procedures in the treaty and backed out for reasons which I don't think the Russians appreciate. In fact, I have a strong feeling that if I were they too, I could understand very carefully that those weapons could be dual purpose, Russia, anti-Russia, or anti-Iran. The list can continue along this line. Every time we have something we want to see, they can see it from a different perspective in how it causes them difficulties. The very issue of the Ukraine, this discussion between two American state officials, got them excited. Of course we're involved in Ukraine, but the Ukraine is like Cuba and Mexico compared to the United States. It is an issue which is strikes to the heart of Russia's existence. One might remember that Kiev was where Russia, in large measure, developed. Kiev is now in the Ukraine. But I'd like to make a point that Eric made earlier, just going back to what Dan was talking about. Russia might not be a state trying to have some sort of great power role, but they have an attitude which developed after the fall of the Constantinople. They were the heart of the Christian religion. They were the soul. And this influenced the Tsarist behavior for a number of years. And there's no question in my mind it's an element of the Russians' population attitude towards a mission in the world. They are different, they perceive.
Yeah, and that shapes a lot of what we're talking about.
And Eric mentioned that earlier, and I just want to raise it.
Yeah. Well, and Eric, a question for you. You know, Colonel Ingram said that Russians, some of them, expected more from the U.S. in terms of help adjusting after the fall of the Soviet Union. But you said in your experience, even when groups tried to go in and help, they were suspected, told no, rounded up, whatever.
Yeah, and I think a lot of those groups, though, also represented kind of a minority, at least in the 90s. You know, a lot of the civil society organizations were maybe in some of the larger urban centers, whereas, you know, the vast majority of the Russian, this vast country, I don't think had the same drive to democratize or modernize. I think, and then when economic conditions were bad and people didn't have bread, they were willing to let go of those democratic ideals and go for strong leadership instead. And I think that's... That's part of where Russia's difference comes from. And I would just add to that discussion about what Russia's role is as a power that, there's nothing that says a great power has to have a particular moral mission.
This is getting back to Mariana's point.
Right. But what is true, I think, is that norms have come to matter a great deal in the international community. And for in the last 25, 30 years, we've seen a vast democratization in Latin America and even in Africa. And there's been more shared norms about, you know, what constitutes the international society. And Russia is not on board there the way that everyone expected they would be. And I think part of the reason for that is this kind of backsliding away from democratization in Russia, and which has influenced their relations abroad.
That's really interesting. So they seem like a latecomer to the party.
Well, not just a latecomer to the party. We're not sure if they're coming.
Yeah.
I think that'll change because I am also a little bit optimistic that Russia will change. I think they do care about human rights enough that they released prominent prisoners like Khodorkovsky recently before the Olympics. But part of it is that their economy is so dependent on oil right now that Putin really has a lot of power until the economy diversifies more, I think, and other voices come in.
You know, you use the word democracy, Professor Klevin, and I want to ask you, Ambassador Benjamin, and maybe everybody else too, a question that one of my kids asked me a couple months back. He said, "Mom, is Russia a democracy?" And you know, Ambassador Benjamin, I wasn't really sure how to answer that question. How would you answer it?
Laura, I guess I'd answer it by saying It's a very imperfect democracy and perhaps not quite a democracy yet. Can I just go back for one second, though, to the issue of Russia's grievances with us?
Yes.
So there are two, I think, that are outstanding. One is that the Russians from the end of the Cold War on expected that the United States would have a very special relationship with Russia, one that acknowledged its greatness in a way that is not true of our relations with other countries. In other words, they felt it humiliating to have gone through the breakup of the Soviet Union and the economic collapse that came, and felt nonetheless that because of Russia's role in the 20th century and its importance as a superpower, that we nonetheless had to have a close relationship and, in fact, in some ways, a kind of cooperative relationship in running the world. And I think they've been consistently disappointed in that. That's one thing. The other area in which they really have a grievance is that since the end of the Cold War, they resent how the United States has driven the international agenda on issues of war and peace and on particularly those that affect national sovereignty. And so there was a lot of resentment about our intervention in the Balkans. There was absolute furor over Iraq and the sense that we had willfully misinterpreted UN Security Council resolutions to give us authority to go in there. They felt, I think, to some extent betrayed about what happened in Libya, and that's why they've really dug in their heels on Syria. So that's a real fault line, and they get a lot of support from China on this because sovereignty is enormously important to China because of the Taiwan issue and I think general Chinese historical insecurity about, you know, the unity of China. So those are really the big things that have, I think, been driving a lot of what we're seeing from Putin. And as for democracy, no, I wouldn't say it really meets our test, because an important part of democracy is maintaining the rights of minorities and the rule of law. And Russia doesn't really pass that test yet. It's better than it was, but we're still not there yet.
Well, and better than China, I would say, if we're going to be comparative, Ambassador Benjamin. What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, it's still a freer press than in China. There's a lot more economic freedom than in China. But I don't think any American would consider it a free society compared to what we have now.
So it's interesting, Colonel Ingram, Ambassador Benjamin seems to be saying, you know, Russia sees itself as an important counterbalance to what they see as the misuse of American power on the world stage. We need to be out there acting, and often acting in contrast to what America would like.
Well, Russia can play this sovereignty card like China in two ways. It is in their interest, but it's also in the interest of maintaining what is in the long-standing an element of international law. And we have, from a different standpoint since the end of World War II, looked at sovereignty as something that is not absolutely perfect. When you have human rights issues, when you have other issues like that, such as in Rwanda and genocide, there is a sense of authority. There's even a view, the responsibility to protect. The West has moved in this direction, and the Russians and the Chinese, for very good reason from their perspective, don't like this. On the other hand, if we just take about how many people look at how we've behaved in recent years in use of military force as opposed to considering other options, I'm with Ambassador Benjamin. I was opposed to the war. I couldn't see any nuclear weapons. If you looked at nuclear weapons, how in the world could the IAEA miss them? And you have to have this, what you've got in Iran to have them.
This is the Atomic Energy Agency.
Yeah. So we have behaved in a way which reinforces their counter behavior. And it was going to happen anyhow, I think. But on the democracy side of the House, I agree with Dan, that they're imperfect, but they're on a trajectory which most likely is going to give the opportunity for future generations to continue to make it better. And so our children and grandchildren will see a very different Russia, even if they have, well, they always will have a sense of Russian interest first and foremost.
Just as we've seen a very different Russia in our own lifetime.
Ma'am.
So how would you define it? How would you answer that question from a child? Is Russia a democracy?
Well, first and foremost, they've got a constitution which they, to some degree, abide by. and try to justify their actions in accordance with it. That allows them to move towards being a constitutional democracy. Do they have a response to the people? Do they have the institutions which allows that response to exist? No, and Putin has taken strong steps to ensure they are not going to grow. I've just answered, as I think the word earlier used by Dan was, they're in an imperfect democracy, perhaps moving towards what we would consider a Western constitutional democracy.
How much do you think, Eric Klevin, a lot of the Western criticisms, a lot of the tensions, a lot of the grievances, how much is this about Vladimir Putin? There seemed to have been some thawing when he was not in power, when I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, Medvedev, when he was president and Putin was underneath him. How much is this about Vladimir Putin, and how much is this about bigger stuff that we've talked about this hour?
Well, it's about Putin, but Putin represents a certain direction in Russian policy. And so whoever follows Putin, we'll have to see who that is and which direction will they take Russia in. I tend to be optimistic, like my colleagues, that I think we will see a different Russia than we see today. But I'm not sure it's the Russia that we probably want to see. It won't be the ideal Russia that we want to see, because it will be different than the Russia that we would see based on Western ideals. So Russia will probably go its own way, and I do think it will open up, but it remains to be seen exactly how.
So Putin is reflecting values of the people he represents.
I think so, yeah. At least of one sector of the society, sure.
I just want to close out with an email from Jen in Durham. She says she was fortunate to host a Russian exchange student, spent several weeks with a group of students that were seniors in high school. They were smart, mature, driven. The greatest surprise was that they were also passionate, funny, and warm. Jen says, just like with America, I don't think it's fair to judge the people based on the actions of government. Well said, Jen. Thank you very much for that email. And I want to thank the three of you for being with us. Ambassador Benjamin, thank you for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Ambassador Daniel Benjamin, director of the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth. He'll be giving a symposium there later today on this topic. You can find out more on our webpage, nhpr.org. Professor Klevin, it was good to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
That's Eric Klevin, assistant professor in the politics department at St. Anselm College. And Colonel Ingram, welcome back. It was good to have you.
Glad to be back.
That's Colonel Lionel Ingram. He's a lecturer in political science at UNH, teaches courses in international relations, including U.S.-Russia relations. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, grading Greek life on campus. For some students, it's a rite of passage to pledge to that fraternity or sorority for a sense of community and lifelong friendships. But after a series of recent ugly incidents, hazing, binge drinking, sexual assault, colleges are looking harder at Greek organizations and whether some are getting out of control. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 on New Hampshire Public Radio. New Hampshire weather, partly to mostly sunny, cold today, highs from teens to lower 20s. Clear cold tonight, lows from 18 below in northern Coos County, ranging to around zero along the Mass border. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes from Sunapee Cove Assisted Living on Lake Sunapee and George's Mills. Chef-prepared meals and engaging activities in a lakeside atmosphere that celebrates life. Models open daily. SunapeeCove.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm.
Ski resorts often depend on snowmaking machines to provide what nature has not. But snowmaking equipment cannot work if temperatures rise above the freezing mark, and the world is getting warmer. Climatologists report